Welcome back to the American Heritage Podcast. I have a special guest for you guys today by the name of Otis McGregor. Otis spent 25 years in the U.S. Army, where he served as a Green Beret. He has been all over the world in Iraq and Afghanistan and Kosovo, setting up special operations units and developing leadership skills. He retired as a lieutenant colonel, and now he has his own company called LTO Enterprises, where he helps businesses develop their own leadership skills. You can check out his website at lto-enterprises.com.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Thank you.
Good. Got you loud and clear.
Good. Good thing we didn't do this any earlier, because we had not a really bad thunderstorm, but one of those ones where, man, the thunder and lightning were actually, I think my neighbor's house got hit.
So, really?
Yeah, one of those ones where it's flash bang, not bang, and then, or, you know, those delayed ones. It was,
Remind me, what part of the country you live in?
Colorado Springs.
Okay, yeah. So I'm in Kansas. So yeah, we got the same, you get it before I get it, basically.
Yeah.
It hits you.
I guess the weathermen refer to it as the monsoon season, right?
Yeah. Now. Yeah, I remember we hiked Pikes Peak a while back, and as soon as we got to the top, it started thunderstorming like crazy, and we still had to walk all the way down. We ended up fetching a ride, which was pretty nice of this lady to hook us up with that, get us three sweaty dudes in the back of her car. So, kind of saved us, though.
I remember years ago when we first moved out here from Devens, one of the things we had to do annually was do a long range movement with our team. And what the battalion commander decided to do was that we would do Pikes Peak. And we got up above, kind of halfway between the tree line and the summit house, and a thunderstorm hit. So we just hauled ass as quick as we could to the summit house, got up there. And then of course it hailed and snowed and all that stuff. And we hung out there for a while, and finally it looked like it broke. So we made the push to get down, and the same thing happened about halfway, kind of that point of no return.
Yep.
It hit again, man. There was a couple of times where I could feel the hair on the back of my neck standing up, because the lightning, you know, the static electricity and the lightning, they always say that, you know, if you feel that, that means you're about to get hit or it's going to hit right next to you.
Yeah.
Man, it got, yeah, that's the only time I've ever felt it. And that was some afternoon.
Yeah, once you're up there above that tree line, you know, I mean, you're the tallest thing around, so it's coming for you.
And all those granite rocks and iron and,
Yeah, that's a good time. I'm going to go back there. I'm going back to Colorado next month. We're going to go west of Denver a ways in the mountains and see what's up. There's a couple places where there's some old B-17 wrecks on some trail.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I've heard about that. Yeah, I have heard about that.
So we're going to hike up to one of those and check that out. They used to fly those out of Western Kansas all the time, out over the Rockies. And there are probably some training bases there in Colorado, too, for World War II bombers. And, several of them crashed. And you can hike up to a lot of these and kind of check them out.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, so that'd be a lot of fun. So, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and probably start recording this and just kind of get it going. I just had a couple of basic questions for you. But tell me a little bit, if you wouldn't mind, about some of your experiences. I know that you were in the military and you were in the Army. Is that correct?
Yeah, I did 25 years in the Army. I started off as a tank driver in the Texas Army National Guard, the Lone Star Division.
Nice.
Yeah.
So what brought you from Texas as a tank driver to what you ended up doing? Like, how did that transition happen?
Well, the reason I enlisted is I was already a cadet at Texas A&M in the Corps, and I had some upperclassmen who were in the Guard, and they're like, "Hey man, this is a great way for you to get a little bit of experience as a soldier, and more importantly, make some money so you can buy beer." So, and then they said, "Well, and we'll drive you," because we were down in College Station, and our unit, that unit I first enlisted for, was in Fort Worth, my hometown. So they would drive me up to hometown, you know, and We do drill, and I did that for about a year and a half, and went to basic training out at Fort Knox. I stumbled onto Stripes the other day, and you know the obstacle course and the barracks there in Stripes.
Mm-hmm.
That obstacle course was the obstacle course I ran in basic training.
Nice.
And then the barracks that they were in was the reception station when I showed up at Fort Knox. So it was pretty funny. But after that, for about a year and a half, I knew that wasn't what I wanted to do. I didn't want to drive around in a steel coffin. I wanted my feet planted firmly on the ground. And I was able to shift over because I had a couple of other friends who were in a recon platoon, Air Cav recon platoon that was the division's reconnaissance platoon. So I shifted over to that. My last 2 years of college, my junior and senior year, they reclassified me as a Cav scout, but we were really a what used to be called LRSU, Long Range Reconnaissance Surveillance Unit. For the armored division, and that was another great experience. So, yeah,
that's pretty cool. I actually met a German guy at work the other day who was in a West German military long range armored reconnaissance unit.
Mm.
He was telling me about when the wall came down, and then they made a mad dash into Yugoslavia, and he was telling me about how some of the craziness that went down after that. And it's pretty interesting.
Oh, I can only imagine what it would have been. My sister-in-law was posted in Stuttgart when the wall came down. I've still got, now you can't quite see it. Just out of view. She brought back a piece of the wall for me. And it's like a little fist sized chunk. And I mounted it on a block of wood. And one of these days I probably ought to label it. So when I forget what things are, I know what that is.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be cool. I've heard a lot of stories. Did you? What years did you serve in the military?
Let's see. I enlisted in 84, got commissioned in 87, and then retired in 2009.
Okay.
25 years.
Yeah, so you were there pretty much for everything then, you know, Cold War, Bosnia, Gulf War, Global War on Terror. Like you... I mean, you did it all.
Yeah, I had, I wouldn't say I did it. I didn't get to do it all, unfortunately. Yeah. Gulf War I, I protected the pipelines in Alaska, quote unquote, because it got to the point where we were all submitting requests to shift units to deploy to Iraq to support the invasion, the old 4187s. It got so bad that the battalion commander had to threaten us with a UCMJ if anybody submitted another one. And then they told us we had this critical mission for critical site defense against the Soviets, you know, or the Russians, I guess. Yeah, it was Russians by then. The Russians on the pipeline. So we tried to push ourselves out to the pipeline pump stations, and I can't remember, was it BP or whoever the company was like, no thanks. You guys get away because you break shit. So so we went back to Fort Wainwright and, you know, twiddled our thumbs and dug snow caves. So while the war was going on.
Yeah. Well, there was plenty of other ones, you know, after that too. You spent some time in Bosnia, is that right? In that whole area?
Yeah, I did some time in Bosnia. Couple of trips in Kosovo also. So when I was in Bosnia, it was with my second ODA. We went into a little town called Srebrenica in the Bosnian side. Spent a few months there, and then for some tactical reasons, they shifted us over to the Serb side, a town called Doboj. And we spent about four months there doing the joint commissioned officer, joint commissioned operations. I can't remember what the O stands for, JCO mission, basically being the eyes and ears and knowing what the population and the key leaders were thinking and doing as things were developing there in the area. It was, you know, it was a lot of fun. I had a great team, and then they plussed us up and we moved to Doughboy with four SEALs. So I had my ODA of, I think there was 10 of us from my ODA, and then had four SEALs assigned to us. And yeah, a recipe for disaster, but the guys that came in, and then our team really well melded well and had a great operation and had some great successes while we were there. I guess good enough that some bad guy, and they never proved who it was, some bad guy put a bomb underneath my truck at our house and blew up my truck and injured my medic. So, yeah, fun stuff. You know, those were the days, but well before the IEDs. This was just a block of C4 with a pull fuse that, you know, the guy had just slid underneath the truck and it did his damage.
Yeah. a little more rudimentary. Were they getting that kind of stuff from the Russians, you think, or is that leftover munitions from, before the Civil War or whatever?
Yeah, that's all the stuff they had was from armories from, the pre-Civil War when it was Yugoslavia, and when Yugoslavia fell and it became those separate entities, the armories, the security on the armories, people just went in and took shit. And whether by force or just, walking in and, looting it, if you will.
Yeah, that's crazy to think about. I read an article one time, and it was a U.S. congressman went to Russia after the wall fell, and they toured this armory, and there was one Russian soldier, looked like he was about 15 years old, he said. Looks like he hadn't been fed regularly and definitely hadn't been paid in months, but one Russian soldier was guarding this entire munitions factory. And so the congressman walked into the plant, and there's just rockets and mortars and, all kinds of arms. He picks up a mortar shell and stuffs it in his briefcase. Nobody notices. He did it just to kind of prove a point, the lack of security when the Soviet Union fell. I thought that was pretty crazy.
Yeah, well, it happened in Yugoslavia. I mean, all over Bosnia and Serbia and those areas. And then when Kosovo happened, we had the same problem happening in Kosovo, the things that were just popping up on the street. And it's like, how the hell did you get that? Oh, well, we just took it out of the armory sort of thing. And, Billy Bob decided he didn't want it anymore, so we're going to give it to you. Thanks.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. So did you ever serve in Iraq and Afghanistan too?
Yeah, I did. I was in Iraq, like 2006, working out of Balad, and was doing some stuff for SOCSENT, their J3X, and then the JSOC task force. I was working for them at the same time. So I was doing a couple of things there at the headquarters. Did that for a handful of months. It was ironic because when I was here in Colorado, I couldn't get over to Iraq, and it took me PCSing to Stuttgart, Germany to get into SOC year to finally work for an organization that would allow me to go play in the sandbox, if you will.
Yeah.
So I did that, helped stand up a couple of things for the SOCSENT J3X, get a couple of things going there. I came home back to Stuttgart, SOC year in the J3. There did a couple of projects there. We were starting on some concepts for the NATO Special Operations Coordination Center is what it was called then. And then I got a phone call one night from the assignments guy that said, hey, there's General Phelan is putting together a team to go into Iraq to build some things. And your name came up. And I said, well, I just came back. What are my options? Da, da, da. And he said, well, your options are that the general asked for you. I said, oh, okay. Because that was my first, everybody talks about a by name request. That was the first time that, somebody had just kind of out of the blue and said, you know, gone down the list of names and said, Otis. Yep. Otis. I want Otis on this team. And yeah, had that phone call and we went over, I was in Baghdad with the team. We stood up then, and we stood up the Iraqi National Counterterrorism Headquarters there. You know, we had the group guys out of Balad were working with the battalion, you know, the actual counterterrorism force, right outside of BIOP, if I remember. I can't remember where they were now. But they didn't have a national headquarters. So we put together the structure, the layout, the policy requirements, and all those fun things that we all cringe at, but have to exist in order for you to have civilian control over a military force. And that was, I spent another 4 or 5 months there in Balad doing that and getting that up and going. And then Afghanistan was never there for any real long periods of time. It was lots of short trips, mainly in support of getting the NATO Special Operations Headquarters mission going there in Afghanistan. Because at the time we had each NATO nation special ops guys were supporting their region and their national headquarters. We had the U.S. special ops guys. Then you had the task force guys. So you had these three tribes and then throw in the Afghan commandos we were trying to stand up. So what we were trying to do with the NATO special operations was create a centralized command to coordinate those three tribes and the operations between those three tribes so that, you know, we weren't just working in stovepipes. We were actually complementing each other. And it took some effort and took some ass chewings, me receiving them generally, not me. I never, when I was at NATO, I didn't have anybody that would have followed it. It was usually me who got the ass chewing. But you know, it's turned into a pretty damn successful headquarters, you know, there in Mons, Belgium now. And the things that they've created and the successes they've had since, you know, since we scribbled it out on a napkin in a bar, you know, years ago at Sockyer with Admiral McRaven as the boss leading the way.
Oh, yeah. So in your opinion, do you think that the Afghans are capable, or do you think that they have it in them to ever really get to the point to where they can have a cohesive fighting force to take on the Taliban? From what I've seen in the news and from what I've read in books, I kind of have my doubts, but I kind of wanted to just talk to somebody who's been there to kind of see what, you know, what it was like for you when you talked about standing up some of these units in Afghanistan and stuff.
Well, the thing you have to put it into context, one, you know, so these people, one, they were isolated. The only sophistication, and the entire country was in Kabul. And actually, I have a friend of mine who's a Soviet era refugee, and his wife shared with me the photo album that this friend of mine's mother smuggled out when they walked across the border into Pakistan. And it's a family photo album, and there's pictures of their family in Kabul, and let me tell you, it looks like and this is in what, late 70s, early 80s. It looks like U.S. 1960s. Is what women are wearing, go-go skirts and those high boots. They got the that girl hairstyles that flip up, and I was like, you know, there's no way. She's like, yes, this is his mother. That's his mother right there in Kabul at a cafe in Kabul. So when the Soviets went in there, they crushed all the intellectuals. And, you know, my friend's dad was an Air Force colonel, and he was executed at the airfield there in Kabul. And, you know, when you destroy the intellectuals, the people who create policies, you know, the people we complain about, the politicians, policymakers and stuff like that. Well, you know what, as much as we may hate them and get frustrated with them, there's a purpose for them. Right. And when the Soviets went in, they killed all those people. and then bam, gone. So that's problem one. Problem two is the rest of the nation was never seen as a nation. It was a line drawn on the map, pulling together a bunch of tribes. So because these tribes don't have a nationalistic view, they don't understand anything beyond, well, they're getting better, but they don't understand anything beyond their own tribe, then they have no desire to help build a national thing because there was no infrastructure. And infrastructure equals trade. Trade equals exchange of ideas and thoughts and education and growth. And then the Taliban took over for the Soviets, and of course they crushed all the education, put women back, you know, under veils and locked them into houses. And so I guess this is a really long answer to, but I think the point I'm trying to prove is it's not a simple answer and it's a long game. It is not go train these guys, you know, go spend 6 months training a unit and then they should be good. Well, it doesn't work that way because their level of intellectual understanding and their level of problem solving and self-realization and all these things that we as Americans, as first world nations take for granted, particularly as Americans, we take it for granted because we just do it. We fix things, right? Something breaks, you go fix it, right? And if you don't know how to fix it, nowadays you either go on to YouTube and find a video or you go pay somebody to fix it, right? When your truck breaks down, that's what you do.
Yep.
These folks, they don't know how to solve those kind of problems. And partly because they probably never owned a truck. Yeah. Now they're getting that education and it's starting to grow. But man, we are talking, this is a generational thing. This isn't something that my generation, I mean, as frustrated as I am that my generation wasn't able to fix it, I'd hate for us to just walk away because they're not ready to self-govern. They're not ready to self-sustain. There's no economy, that the infrastructure is lacking. It doesn't support the ability of the nation to grow. So, you know, if you don't have that, then chaos ensues and the bad guys come back in and start killing people again.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, you know, that we've been there since 2001, essentially, and it's, you know, taken that long. But like you said, you know, that's they're not wired for self-governance. They're not wired for a national identity. You have thousands of years of tribal culture and stuff that you're trying to undo. And I'm sure it's incredibly complicated, and I don't even pretend to understand it at all. But I did read the other day that they're talking about, you know, peace talks with the Taliban. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that? Do you think that's a smart move or no?
You know, it's possible, but the Taliban, in order for it to really happen, the Taliban would have to give up some of the principles they've been living by and some of the things that they established themselves under, you know, like the suppression of women and women's rights and those things, just, and then the education system. If they do and they actually hold true, you know, good. I'm all about peace. Some people outside the military think that folks in the military are warmongers, you know, but Jesus, man, war is bad.
Yep. You know?
I mean, there ain't no better way of putting it. It's just there's nothing good that comes out of war.
No, you said it. I mean, and you know better than most people. So, you know, I believe you when you say that, you know, you want peace. I hear that a lot from a lot of veterans. You know, I don't talk to anybody that's, you know, gung-ho to go to another war. I mean, most people are reluctant. It's the people who haven't been in the military that seem to be the ones who want to, start a war. And with all these other countries like Iran, and I try to tell some of my friends, you know, that's not the thing we want necessarily. That should be the last option, not the first option.
Yeah. And it's a scary thing because once it starts, you can't turn those things back. You know, once you push the button, once you squeeze the trigger, you can't put the bullet back in the muzzle of the rifle. You know, you can't put the missile back in the silo, all those sort of things. You know, once it happens, you know, it's a mess. And then once it happens, you better figure out how to make it right and how to keep it from being a festering, nasty ass cold sore that just continues to fester and bother you and just be that blistering pain, you know, like Iraq, you know, and Afghanistan, similar things. And like we're seeing, you know, in some countries in Africa too, you know, we got lucky in Bosnia. It's quelled now, I guess is probably the best way to talk about it. Kosovo somewhat, but I would say the animosity is in both those areas is still high, which is something that we as Americans don't understand. But the, you know, the things that happened in Iraq and where, you know, we're uniform, governed and directed by civilians. That's the strength of our nation and that's the strength of our military. But geez, man, there's some times where, you know, I'm just like, oh man, please just let us sit here and take care of this for a little bit longer, you know, another 5-10 years. I understand what the voter, you know, the American population may think and budgets and stuff like that. But, you know, when you pull out before it's fixed and self-governance is ready, man, it's just going to be another mess. You know, goodness gracious, look how long we've been in Korea.
Yeah. Oh,
crap. You know, and you know what? They are highly capable of self-governance. Their military is significantly increased in the last 20 years. But geez, we've been there, what, 60 years, something like that now? I mean, yeah. Jeez. So, you know, when you put things in kind of context like that, and their intellectuals weren't all executed, by the way, either.
Yeah. So do you think that, you know, that's a scenario that if we slowly over time decreased our presence, that they would be kind of be forced to increase theirs and kind of take it a little more seriously?
In Korea or?
Yeah. Korea.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The Koreans are already doing some of that. They just haven't spent the money on it. And I think there's still the Cold War. We still have a little bit of the Cold War sense in us and, you know, preventing the advancement of communism. So that's a, you know, that's part of it, right there. And, you know, Mr. Un, not a stable decision maker from what I've seen and read about him.
Yeah.
So when you get into that category of, unstable leadership, in a nation like that, then that's a little scary. So being able to have something right there at his doorstep, and if that upsets him and makes him kind of stay in his box a little bit, then yeah, we probably ought to do that.
Yeah, definitely. No, I agree. So you got a lot of experience, you know, dealing with some of these high level leadership type things and trying to get things started from nothing. Is that kind of what was a good segue into your organization that you have now?
Yeah, I mean, somewhat, you know, I'll give you a quick little story about how I looked at it. You know, when I was a team leader in a special forces, ODA, we did a lot of focus on what's called, one of our missions was foreign internal defense, right? So it's creating security forces for a nation to be able to sustain itself against this insurgency, defeat an insurgency. That's kind of the paraphrase definition of it. Well, when I was in SOCUR and we started standing up NATO special operations, I went from this high school level FID stuff that I did as a team leader to this PhD level to where we were building this coalition of nations. So, because it didn't exist. So it was an idea that Al McRaven, his very good friend, Brigadier Bradshaw, the SAS commander, and I can picture his face, but I can't think of his name, the French Special Forces commander. These three guys decided that that's, and their governments, all our governments supported him, but that this was what we needed. But what it took was quite literally a campaign where we, and we being Admiral McRaven and Otis or somebody else from the staff traveling around the other nations with him and meeting with the other special operations commanders and then their chiefs of defense and creating this coalition to defend NATO and bring NATO special operations together. So that to me was like this, you know, I'd gone from this high school level, you know, teach a foreign army how to do an L-shaped ambush to creating international and national and influencing other nations' national policies to create this headquarters. So that I thought was, you know, an experience that helped grow me into, what I am doing now, you know, my business now, LTO Enterprises, with the leadership development and, you know, professional coaching, business performance coaching. You know, that experience, along with all my leadership experience that I had in the military, is what's kind of set me up for where I am now.
Yeah, awesome. What does LTO stand for?
Leadership training and operations. That's the official. The unofficial is actually listen to Otis. So years ago, I think it was when I was still in Germany. My kids created, and this is like when Facebook was first coming up to a thing, created a Facebook page called Listen to Otis. You know, doing the dad quote things.
Nice.
And I'd always remembered that. And when I decided to start a business, I was scratching my head. It's like, man, what am I going to name it? What am I going to name it? And my wife said, well, why don't you name it LTO for Listen to Otis? And I'm like, I can't name it that. But then I'm like, wait a second, leadership, training, and operations. There we go. Yeah, there's the official name. So now everybody knows the unofficial name too.
That's awesome. So did you start your business right away when you got out of the military, or did you have like a normal 9-to-5? Like, did you have a laser focus, I guess, of what you were going to do when you got out of the military?
No, dude, man, I struggled for 7 years. So I retired in 2009 and I worked in the defense contracting industry as a business development guy at all different levels and different size companies. And what I did was I started LTO as a consulting firm doing business development. And I'd do that for a while, and then somebody would give me a full-time job, and I'd work for them for a while. And I'm like, man, this is it. This is the one. You know, I'm going to work for this guy or this company for the next 20 years, paying benefits. And then I'd get behind the curtain and something wasn't right, and I didn't agree with decisions that were made. And, you know, and it's like morale, whatever, you know, you name it. Just wasn't sitting right. It wasn't fulfilling. So then I'd leave and I consult for a little bit and somebody give me a job. And I did that for a good six, seven years until, you know, 3 years ago. Yeah, I guess it was about 3 years ago. I was sitting here in my office one summer day feeling sorry for myself. I was working for a small business. The owner was a friend of mine, had a great setup. The company was based in Fort Worth where I grew up. So I'd go back down to Fort Worth for, you know, to be at the company headquarters, and I'd go visit my mom and dad, my in-laws, my old stomping grounds, and only traveled when I wanted to. I was coaching boys rugby at the time and I hated it. I was not happy. It sucked.
This sounds terrible.
Yeah. Oh, it was. I was just frustrated, man. It wasn't filling the cup up. And I started scratching my head that afternoon when I was feeling sorry for myself. And I was like, well, what is it I like to do? And I said, well, I really like coaching rugby. I enjoy coaching rugby because every day I go out there, you know, and when the boys start showing up, no matter how crappy my day was, it all goes away. And I started to think, well, you know, I love the game of rugby. I love my boys. But what I really realized was it's the act of coaching. It's the act of giving people, helping people achieve their goals and their objectives and develop their skills for solving their own problems and how they can solve them. That's where I get all fired up. That's where I get excited. Helping people become better leaders, helping organizations grow because they have better leaders. And when organizations get better and their people are better leaders, then that organization influences their communities to be better. And when we have great communities, then we have a better world, you know? And so it just excites me, you know? I mean, it's something that I enjoy the heck of out of, you know. A couple of weeks ago, I was down in Florida, doing some leadership training for Pasco County Sheriff, their leadership team, sergeants and lieutenants and captains. And man, I still get excited about that and talking with those guys and hearing their experiences and helping them become better leaders so they can lead their, you know, their shift or their teams, you know, and make better decisions out in the community when they're operating with their people in their community. You know, that's great stuff. I get excited about that.
Yeah, that sounds pretty awesome. So you go in there and teach them leadership skills. So what kind of, like, what are some, like, generic advice that you just – do you kind of go in and, like, assess the situation, or do you kind of go in with something you know is going to apply to generally everybody?
A little bit of both. So I use an assessment tool from the coaching course I went through. It's called – the coaching course I went through is called Institute Professional Excellence in Coaching, IPEC, and we use an assessment called Energy Leadership Index Assessment, which measures your energy levels in the moment. Now, I'll translate that into what it really means, and this is why I like it, because I don't have to use the F word, feelings. And what I've realized is, and the reason I like this system so much is we don't have to worry about, well, I don't feel good, I'm happy because my feelings are happy, or I'm feeling sad. No, we talk about it in energy levels and low levels and a catabolic level of victim. Why does this always happen to me? All the way up to, you know, this visionary of, wow, man, I'm not just going to solve this problem. I'm going to create solutions to other problems as I do this and with this high anabolic energy. So, you know, I give this assessment and we talk about those energy levels. So I educate people on those energy levels. And generally the thing everybody walks away with really in the energy levels is an understanding of three things. One, there's negative energy, there's positive energy. And then the third piece that's critical is you have the decision, the ability to make the decision of whether or not you act in a positive or negative energy. So if something triggers you and you feel sad, you know, you're upset, then you have the choice of your next action. Do you take action pissed off or feeling sorry for yourself? Or do you take action like, well, no, okay, that happened, so now I'm going to fix it, right? So you develop this understanding, and it gets a little bit more in depth than that. But you develop this understanding as a leader. So now you know as a leader that, this is probably not the right way that I should be feeling when I make these decisions or when we go into this planning phase or when I start to look at options on what I need to do. And how do you handle that? And where do you go from there in order to make better decisions? Because when you're in a negative mindset, negative energy mindset, you can't see the future because all you're worried about is why is everything always happening to me? Why is this happening again? But when you're anabolic and much more optimistic, you can see the future. And when you can see the future, you can see second and third order effects to that decision you're making. And that's a critical piece that as a leader, you have to be able to do is you have to be able to understand by making this decision at this point. And we talk about that too, and when to make decisions and how you know. But when I make this decision, what's the second and third order effect of me making this decision? How does it affect what's going to happen tomorrow, next week, next month, next year? You know, it's the the things that it's the, you know, to use a term we used to talk about, it's tactical actions with strategic implications.
Yeah. Right?
And you have to be aware of those things.
Yeah, that's awesome advice. So for somebody to take a step back and realize, okay, maybe I'm making decisions from a negative point of view, what's a good way to kind of get out of that mindset and get to that high anabolic state instead?
Everybody has their own little technique, you know. I mean, you can do it. It's grounding is one of the things I like to refer to it as. So, you know, whether you close your eyes, and you take 3 deep breaths, you stomp your foot twice, you get up and do 10 push-ups, whatever. Something to, once you realize it, so you have to have this conscious understanding of this is what's going on to me. This is how my energy levels are right now. And that's not how I want to go forward. Then you have to know that first. You have to have that self-awareness. And then you have to make that conscious choice. And, you know, depending on how severe it may be, depends on what you need to do. You know, do you need to go to the gym and, you know, toss some iron around to break the cycle? You know, sometimes you don't have that opportunity, you know, but using having something, tools that you develop yourself, a grounding tool, whether it's, like I said, stomping your foot or just close your eyes and take 3 deep breaths and let them out. You'd be amazed at how quickly, once you start doing that, then those things don't dig as deep either, because you become more conscious of them also. And when you're more conscious of them, you also know, okay, well, why would I get upset about that? There's no need to be upset about that anymore. It's really not that big a deal. Okay.
Yeah, that's kind of where the ego comes into play too. You know, it's easy to kind of get your ego wounded and then, you know, want to be right or react. So trying to take a step back and recognize that the ego is the one doing a lot of the thinking right now. And that would help a lot in those situations.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, one of the things that you'll also learn is the higher your anabolic energy, the more optimistic you are, if you will, the less judgment you have. And that goes with not just somebody walking by that you may think, oh man, what the hell's wrong with that guy? It doesn't just mean that. It also means judgment of your own ideas. You know, that, you know, so go back to, remember what I said, high anabolic, you don't just solve problems, you create solutions to other problems that you didn't even know existed, right? That's what we're talking about in visionary. And you have to have this high anabolic energy in order to see that, because if you were not, then you judge it. And you're like, that'll never work. It's not worth trying. Why would I, you know, that's just stupid. That's a stupid idea.
Yeah.
Is it? I mean, dude, did you give it a chance? Did it even come off your tongue, right? You don't know. But you have to have that anabolic energy in order to really be willing to take that leap and go out there and get it.
No, that's solid advice. What kind of advice would you give to somebody who's getting out of the military pretty soon? You know, I mean, you said it took you kind of 7 years to find your thing.
I'm a slow learner.
Yeah, no, I am too. I mean, I learn everything the hard way. So what would you tell somebody getting out of the military? Like, what's the best advice that you wish somebody might have told you?
Well, first thing is there are so many organizations out there that provide service to help you transition. I volunteer with 3 of them who help veterans transition into civilian life and find their next adventure. One of them is called Stand Beside Them. And they coach veterans, spouses, and veteran caregivers in transition from the military into civilian life and finding their next adventure. The other one is the Commit Foundation. The Commit Foundation focuses on special operators and high level performers and doing that similar thing and helping them figure out that next path. And then Your Grateful Nation focuses on, Army Special Forces and helping them find that solution. And then I'm an ambassador for the Green Beret Foundation, and Green Beret Foundation is building up the next ridge line, which is helping people find jobs and, you know, job postings and connections in that sense. So that's the use the organizations, because there is a crap load of them out there. And that's number one. Number two is don't take the first thing that falls in your lap, because you're better than that. Now, it might be the right thing, but make sure that you're looking at it in the right sense. Does it fulfill your passion? Does it uphold your values? You know, are you going to feel fulfilled at the end of the day? It might be a nice paycheck, but you know, if you're deploying back to Afghanistan for 6 months and then home for 2 weeks, is that what you want? It may be. I'm not saying it wasn't right for me. But you know, there's people out there that are plenty happy with doing that. So, you know, but it's just because you're no longer in the military doesn't mean you have to take the very first thing. And then one other thing I'll say is don't be alone, because one of the great tools that we all have when we're in the military is that team and that camaraderie. That still exists. It's just, you're just not in the barracks. You're not at the mess hall. You're not deployed together, or not doing PT together and stuff like that. But you can still be part of those organizations, whether it's Special Forces Association, Veterans, VFW, you know, all those sort of organizations that exist out there that, you know, was Grandpa's thing that he did. Well, guess what? You know, there's a reason Grandpa was part of those organizations. So
yeah,
you should be too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's awesome advice. You said, don't take the first thing that comes along. I totally did that and it sucked. I worked in a cubicle for a while and about lost my damn mind, but yeah, I took the first thing that came along. You know, I was like, I needed a job. Well, here it is. I'll figure the rest out later. year and a half later, I was like, oh my God, what did I get myself into? But you know, like I said, I learned all my lessons the hard way. So lesson learned.
Yep. Yep. I mean, that's, you know, if you look at it that way and you look at a lot of things that we do in life that way, you're going to be a lot better off for it, as opposed to wallowing and, you know, doing the butt in your head. That was a stupid idea. Stupid, stupid, stupid. No. God damn, man. You just learned a lesson, right? Why don't you apply that lesson?
Yep.
Move forward.
Absolutely. So with your organization, what's the best way, if somebody wanted to have you come and speak at their company, how would they get a hold of you?
Well, my website, www.lto-enterprises.com. And I've got a couple of buttons there at the top. You can sign up for my newsletter, which I'll be starting end of this month. Also got the you can sign up or schedule a free consultation call with me. I've also started my podcast, and you know, the podcast that my son and I, so it's called the Cam and Otis Show. We released our first episode last week. So it's fun, because you know, my son is 23. They're just a couple of decades, like three, between us, 3 and 1 year. So yeah. not cutting myself short. I'm not trying to say I'm not old, but it's a lot of fun, because he's an entrepreneur, and, you know, we have a great time. We both love sports. We love leadership. He's a behavioral economics closet nerd, loves economics. And so he'll throw down some big economics words, and I put him back in his 23-year-old place with my old man wisdom of, can't you just say that in three simple words rather than having to say that big fancy, you know, college boy word. So yeah, we have a great time. So that's just kicking off. So you can watch for the Cam and Otis Show, more of those episodes coming out. And, I try to post a couple of videos a week, little 1 minute, thought provokers, everything from, planning, like I did a series in the last couple of weeks on PACE, something we use in the Green Berets, primary, alternate, contingency, emergency for your planning. and talking about energy levels and performance. And so, yeah, there's a bunch of 1 minute videos that are also on my V blog, on my website, and you can find them on Facebook and Instagram. Follow me on Instagram. It's another great thing to do too. So.
Awesome. Hey, I want to thank you for coming on the show. You know, it is really awesome to talk to you. Do you have any, like parting wisdom you want to leave anybody who's listening today?
You know, probably the biggest thing is understanding that you have a conscious choice to how you take action, right? You don't have to take it as a happy guy. You don't have to take it as a pissed off guy. You have that choice. You know, it's up to you, and it's your decision to decide whether or not how you take action going forward in life and what you do with it.
Yeah, that's awesome advice. Thank you for that.
Thanks, Seth. This has been a lot of fun. I appreciate you having me on the show. Enjoyed talking with you today, too.
Yeah, it was a good time. You're welcome back anytime you want to come on.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the show. Be sure to check out the new website at www.AmericanHeritagePodcast.com. There you can find blog articles that I write, and also there's a tab for merchandise. There you can find new shirts that I have. I have one on right now. It's called the Max Effort, and it features an F-105 Thunder Chief dodging an SA-2 North Vietnamese anti-aircraft missile over the Ho Chi Minh Trail. This shirt was inspired by a conversation I had with Wild Bill in one of the earlier episodes. Be sure to check out that episode and head to the website to pick up your shirt today. Thanks for listening to the American Heritage Podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have, be sure to subscribe, rate, review, and share with your friends. Also, if you wouldn't mind, please consider being a donor. You can click on the support tab at the bottom of the show notes of this episode and every other episode. If you do that, you'll help offset some of the costs that come along with podcasting. Also, I will give a percentage of the proceeds straight back to homeless veterans via the Passageways LTD organization. They help homeless veterans get off the streets once and for all. So consider being a donor today. Once again, thanks for listening.